online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Oenologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, the highlights of Series 13, Oz Clark OBE. We're celebrating English sparkling with Nye Timbers Sherry Spriggs and Stephen Duckett of Hundred Hills. There's Romain Ott of Chateau Leube, Emmanuel Pesquera, Group Head of Wine for Gordon Ramsay, and author of Corker, Hannah Crosby. There are few names more famous in the world of wine communication than Oz Clark. Awarded an OBE for his work, his career dates back to the 1980s, when, as an actor, he shot to fame with Gilly Goulden on the BBC's Food and Drink. He has a host of writing credits to his name as well, of course, and his latest book is Oz Clark's Story of Wine, a collection of fascinating facts told largely through anecdotes. We spoke about Champagne's illustrious history, including what are known as the blood vintages.
Blood vintages are absolutely fantastic. That's particularly 1914 and 1915, but it's also anything else during that period. And very occasionally, there are bottles of 1914, 1915 wines that are opened. And I think they are, I've never had one, but I think they are still drunk over 100 years on with a certain sense of reverence and a certain sense of quiet thoughtfulness. It's a bit like in our country, Remembrance Day comes up every November, and there's no one alive who was there. But Remembrance Day, even for much, much younger people, still seems to be more about the First World War than about the Second World War. There's something about the humanness of the battles, the humanness of the destruction, the terrible personal stories that we seem to have managed to get so many of the First World War, which still hits us. And the First World War, gosh, the very first Battle of the Marne took place at Reims, Reims. And it was in 1914. It was September. They were just about getting ready for the harvest, and it was going to be a really good harvest, the 1914 harvest. And everyone was saying, oh, lovely, lovely. And a few people said, excuse me, the Germans are behaving pretty badly just north of us. It's not very far. It's good old tank country. They'll be through in a minute. And they said, no, let's get vintage sorted. But of course, the Germans came and they just ripped through Reims, and then they headed further south to Epernay. So to do that, you go through all those great vineyards of the Montagne de Reims, and you go round the Montagne de Reims onto the River Marne, and you get to the River Marne at Epernay. Again, you've got all these wonderful vineyards there, and Paris is only a few days away. And there was an amazing, I think it was called the Taxis of the Marne, which they all got all the taxis in Paris, just filled them full of people and sent them down to Epernay to try and hold back the Germans from reaching Paris. Otherwise, if it wasn't for that, the Germans would have reached Paris by the second week of September in 1914, and goodness knows how different the war might have been. They were pushed back, and that meant that there was another massive battle of the Marne, which basically liberated Reims. I feel like calling it Reims, because whenever any sort of military people are talking about it, they always call it Reims. Anyway, Reims, Reims. And it meant that the front line between Germany and France for the next 3 or 4 years was going to be the city of Reims. And the city of Reims was what? 150, 120,000 people. By the end of it, there were only a few hundred civilians left in there, because it'd been 4 years of bombardment. The front line went through the Grand Cru vineyards of around the Montagne de Reims. The 1914 vintage, therefore, was brought in under continual shelling. The 1915 vintage was brought in under continual shelling. That basically, by that time, of course, it was women and children and old guys doing it, because everyone else was being recruited into the army. So quite a few people died. We don't know how many people died, but certainly there are stories of young children dying picking the grapes, women dying picking the grapes. Probably far more died than that. But the whole of Reims then, because it was absolutely riddled with ancient cellars, which were started by the Romans, where all the champagne houses now store and did store all their millions and millions of bottles of champagne, they were all taken over by the government, by the army, and also by the people who were left in Reims, because Reims was bombarded. They started bombarding Reims in September 1914. And I'm not sure how many days they went on bombarding them for, but basically I think they were shelling Reims for 1,050 days. Every single day, overcame the shells. And in that time, they went on making wine. And the 1914 and the 1915 vintages, therefore, were brought in and vinified and aged in a time of intense military activity and in enormous civilian distress. This great city of Reims just completely destroyed. I believe there wasn't a house in Reims left, a building in Reims left that hadn't been hit by a shell of some sort. And those are the blood vintages. And it's a wonderful story. And it chills you even to this day just thinking. As for me, every November when Armistice Day comes along and when Remembrance Sunday comes along, I get out there and I am to this day chilled by the memory of that terrible war over 100 years ago.
Absolutely. And we do get to have some extraordinary experiences in this world, and you've had many more than I have. But one of mine was tasting at Paul Roget, a bottle of the 1914 vintage. I tasted it 5 years ago when I visited, and it was the Vin Surprise that is, as you will know, is opened, and you see the menu and you see what you're going to be drinking with the menu, and then there's a Vin Surprise. And it was the 1914 Paul Roget, as you mentioned, harvested by women, children, pensioners, because all the men were fighting, and it was quite. It had the finest bead of bubbles still, but it was otherwise, Burgundian, I suppose, in character. But it was of course delicious. But yes, the reverence that we held for it and what it represented was just extraordinary. Quite an amazing experience. And you actually feature a bottle, an illustration, a picture of a 1914 bottle of Paul Roget that went under the hammer at auction for, I think, £5,000 or £6,000. You feature that alongside that story in the book.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted that you had that bottle, David, because I think it's not a bottle I've ever had, and I probably never shall. But I'm really pleased that one of my friends has had it. But I also think that it's a rather extreme example of the way that the wine world, to get the best out of it, we don't or we shouldn't just talk about its flavors, and we shouldn't just talk about whether it's Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot or Syrah or God knows what. We should try and look behind the bottle, the flavor, the liquid, to see the people and the times and the place and the history. Because again, when we're lucky to have those old bottles open for us, and I ferret away all these bottles under the stairs. I can't resist aging bottles, because a lot of those bottles that I've got these bottles 30, 40, 50 years old maybe, and I know when I got them all. Every single one of them, I go in there and there's a bottle from Greece, and then there's a bottle from a 1980s vintage of Bordeaux, and then there's a bottle of Burgundy, and oh, that's an old Barossa Valley from 1985, and there's something from the Ukraine in 2009. And every one of them, to me, I know where I got it. I've got one of those quirky memories. I know where I got it. I sort of know what I was doing. And this, it helps me to remember what I was doing, to remember my friends then, to remember what life was like. And to be able to go back to something like 1914 is, to my mind, it's a really precious thing that wine can do. And it's one of these things that wine has, which is completely different to literature or painting or whatever. Wine, to me, a great wine, there are several phases in the pleasure. One of the pleasures is possession, to possess a bottle, to take it out, to look at it, to wonder about it, to put it back again, to think about life, think about times, think about what will it be like, when will I have it? That's one pleasure, and it's a perfectly real pleasure. The second pleasure is that moment when you finally pull the cork, pour the wine, drink the liquid, and that's the most intense of the pleasures. But the third pleasure is the memory for the rest of your life of really special bottles. And then with its peak when you drank it, which is all about maybe its flavors, if they were good enough. Certainly who you were with, where you were, what was happening in the world. And then going right back to that first time you made a decision, I'm going to actually buy that bottle or find that bottle. So it's wine at its best.
Oz Clark, OBE, on wine's extraordinary ability to evoke memories. And as we discuss in that episode, Oz was an early champion for English wine. In fact, Nytimber is one of the iconic UK wineries that features in the book. Its head winemaker is Sherry Spriggs, a Canadian who works in partnership with her husband, Brad Greatrix, also Canadian, and she explained how they both got involved to form a dynamic double act at Nytimber.
My mum and dad are big fans of this country and would visit quite often. And on one trip many, many years ago, they asked me, what can we bring you from England? And I said, well, I've heard about this thing called Nytimber. Could you get me a bottle? I'd like to try it. And that's exactly what they did. They found it, brought it back. At this point, Brad and I were doing our master's degree at the Wine Research Center in Vancouver, Canada. And we sat down one night, middle of the week, no preconceived ideas, opened up this bottle and both went, wow, okay, it's maybe not perfect, but there's a lot of potential here that's really quite interesting. Anyway, some years later, Brad and I had always thought that we would make wine in Canada. And we were looking at various job opportunities that had been presented to us in Canada. And they were fine, but they were opportunities that perhaps we could have been more excited about. Not to say there's not a great industry in Canada, there is, but these particular opportunities were maybe not quite as desirable as what we were hoping for. And we were out for an evening walk one night talking about the future. And Brad just asked me this question. He said, if you could do anything, what would you do? And the first thing I said was, I'd like to make sparkling wine and I'd like to make it in England.
Wow.
And that's because I thought back to this tasting of the wine some years prior. Anyway, we got home and the next day I wrote an email to info@nytimber.com and said, hey, we are two young winemakers and we're wondering, is there enough of a wine industry in the UK to warrant moving there and looking for work? And I had an email back from the lady who was in the cellar at that point in time holding the winemaking position saying, actually, our CEO is looking for two fully qualified winemakers as we speak. So send your CVs. He'd been searching for 6 months. And so off went our CVs. They landed in front of our owner and CEO, Eric Harima. we had a telephone interview, in fact, two telephone interviews. And at the end of that conversation, those conversations, we were offered the opportunity to come to England and start working in the role, see if it was a good fit. And 2 weeks later, we were in England working at Knight Timber. And it didn't take even 2 weeks to figure out that that's exactly where we wanted to be and we wanted to stay. And that was back in February 2007. So many, many, many years ago, though it feels shorter than the actual duration in time that it's been.
Yeah, 17 years ago. And the fact that it wasn't just you looking for a job at the time, it was also Brad. It's pretty incredible. A piece of of serendipity, isn't it?
It is, but I think it's also a good lesson because it took Brad asking that very simple question, if you could do anything or what is your dream job, to go, actually, you know what? Don't forget your dreams. Remember what your dream might be and chase it, because you never know. You might have something as serendipitous as happened with Brad and I. We were right time, right place. But also, I'd say, importantly, really right fit. We were looking for something particular in the owner and CEO of the business that we were going to work with. And he was looking for something in his winemaking team as he looked to the future as well. And that relationship is very important. And it was just such a beautiful fit.
Yeah, I'll say. And you work, as you mentioned, in a double act with husband Brad. I've seen you both present together at various launches. You have this, unsurprisingly, given that you're married, you have this incredibly close and you know, really fascinating relationship. Of course, working with your other half wouldn't be for everyone. It's certainly, much as I love my partner, it wouldn't be for me. So how does that work? You know, the fact that you do everything together.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's a few elements that feed into this. One side is that, in fact, we don't know it any other way. Brad and I met when we were doing our undergraduate degrees. We were doing a bachelor's of science in Canada in biochemistry. And that's where we met. And we started our relationship even studying together. And then we went through our journey of getting into the wine industry, falling in love with wine together. So in one respect, we don't really know it any other way. But also, I like to say, I think sometimes working with your husband or wife could be difficult depending on your industry. You know, we're not two criminal lawyers who come home with a very stressful kind of world that we're dealing with. We're in the wine industry, and our industry is tough. It's hard. There is stress. There's no doubt. But it's also an industry of joy. We're doing what we do because we're making something that people share at some of their most pleasurable times of life. And that's probably the most fulfilling thing of our jobs. And we can very much connect on that. And we love wine. So, you know, we're sharing a common love in what we do. So that makes it all seem rather effortless.
Yeah, it makes sense. Do you always agree on things?
No. You know, when you've been together with someone for as long as Brad and I have been, and we've been tasting and working together for so long, there's a few things. One, we know each other's strengths and weaknesses. So there's certain times and certain areas where I will defer to Brad because I just know he's better at it than me in that particular area, and vice versa. Ultimately, if we don't agree and a decision has to be taken, that's mine to take. I'm the head winemaker responsible for the vineyard department and the winery department. So technically, Brad reports to me. But most of the time, I think because our communication is, we've been working together for so long, our communication is so strong that we mostly can talk through and figure out what is the best solution rather than any hierarchical way of making decisions.
And he's always been very happy that ultimately you're the boss.
Yeah, and hopefully he's okay with that, because I don't consider myself a tyrant.
No, he seems pretty cool with it, to be fair, whenever I've been anywhere near the pair of you. Let's talk about the other man you mentioned there, the boss, Eric Hirima, a really key figure in the industry, you know, larger than life by any measure, and has clearly had an enormous influence on English sparkling wine, not just Nye Timber, because of what he has brought to Nye Timber. You clearly work very well, you and Brad, with Eric.
Very much so. First, if I come back to what I was saying about when we were choosing who we wanted to work with, what we found in Eric that you don't always find in owners and CEOs in the wine industry is someone who has an incredible amount of vision and has a driving force, and he does what he says he's going to do. He's extremely committed, and he looks at the wine industry in a very long-term way. He's not unrealistic about how long it takes to achieve what you want to achieve as a business in this industry. He's also, we bonded quite quickly over our love of wine. He is, I think, since a very young age, since he was a teenager, he has been a passionate wine lover and a wine drinker. And I think you need that. You want someone who's in love with what it is that you're making and trying to achieve. He's an extremely driven man. He's an extremely visionary leader, and he is able to see potential. And I think he could see potential when he took over Nye Timber that just wasn't there in the industry at the time. And he really, you know, we talk about those early days, and we talk about how it felt like we had to justify our existence. We knew what was possible, but there were things that needed to be worked on and improved on and fixed. So we knew where we could get to, and we had to prove that, and we had this to stay the course and do the hard work in order to make that happen. And you don't get that with every leader, but that's very much my experience of Eric.
Yeah, he's notoriously demanding, and there's nothing wrong with that, of course. But he does seem to give you and Brad a lot of creative freedom as well.
Eric is very clear in his vision and leadership, and he's very clear about the people in the business that are experts in their role are expected to be the expert in that area and to bring forward that expertise in proposals and ways forward and what have you. And Eric is very clear about what he's good at and what he's not. And he doesn't pretend to be a winemaker. So he leaves that for us, which also means we're responsible and accountable for what we do. So, you know, it's not free sailing. You still have to work extremely hard and do your job and prove that you're competent in what you're doing.
Sherry Spriggs, the head winemaker at Nye Timber. And we stay with England's fast-evolving wine scene as we move upcountry to a beautiful valley in the Chilterns, home to 100 Hills, which was established a mere decade ago by Stephen Duckett and his wife Fiona. They started from scratch, having undertaken an exhaustive search for the perfect place to produce English sparkling wine. And we began by talking about Stephen's early years.
Look, I grew up on the farms in Somerset. The family had farmed the Somerset levels for generations, you know, nearly 1,000 years, and was very much expected to head onto the farm as I became 16 with a tractor driving license in my back pocket. You know, that it's a beautiful part of the world to grow up, and I loved it out on the farms, but I became entranced with personal computers and computing. I was lucky enough to be pretty good at maths, and so it quickly became apparent that my future lay, at least in the near term, in that part of the tech world. I was lucky enough to go to Oxford to study engineering, economics and management, and I spent time after that then getting more and more deeply involved in the tech world. I had a chance to go to Harvard. And from there, it was all tech for me as the sort of internet revolution landed right in front of me. So this is sort of the early 90s, and we're just beginning to see the very first sort of commercial web browsers. The world was your oyster if you could understand, you know, well enough how to program, how software programming worked, and how you could see how the internet might reshape our lives. It was full of opportunity. And so I spent the next 20 years involved first in very small businesses, getting involved in very young businesses and starting them up through the sort of internet bubble in 2000 and on then into bigger businesses in the internet as those businesses grew and grew. So fantastic first career. A lot of flying back and forth to California because that was the heart of it, as you say, Silicon Valley. And, you know, while I was there, that was, you know, always a love of wine, but certainly, you know, that flying, whenever you flew into San Francisco, particularly in the latter parts of my career, you were inevitably taken out to one of the beautiful wineries in the Napa Valley or the Sonoma Valleys. And the entertainment, the quality of the wines, the whole piece was entrancing, even for someone who was familiar with the world of wine in Europe. And so very important formatively, you know, both in my second career, as I call it, as well as being an enjoyable part of my first.
And I have to be sensitive in the way I ask this. You've clearly done very well. And there is a kind of type of person who goes and, you know, does well and goes and buys a vineyard. And you see that a bit in Napa. You certainly see it in Canada and the Okanagan Valley. And you see these fantastically wealthy silver foxes who don't necessarily... obviously do that much work, but they very much like having the property and having the vineyard. Now, you're not quite that person, really. You are different.
Yeah, definitely not that person. I mean, you know, I grew up on the farms, and so I'd always known my second career would be back out on the land, and I'm pretty entrepreneurial, you know, by nature. And so, you know, I think we'll probably talk about this a little more, but as it became clearer to both my wife, Fiona, and I during the course of the sort of 2000-2010 period, that really making beautiful wines in England was a serious commercial family business proposition. You know, as that became more real, you know, I got very excited about that prospect. But as you say, I'm hands-on. I don't see myself ever retiring at any stage unless I was forced to by ill health or something. But otherwise, you know, I intend to be doing this for a very long time. And, you know, both Fiona and I have enjoyed the whole prospect of getting involved from day one in every little detail here. And I think if for those people, you know, listening who come to see 100 Hills, I hope they'll see what I mean. There's a lot of detail here. It's very personal. We've taken enormous care in the way we put together our vineyards, our winery, and ultimately our wines. So, yes, you know, I'm the winemaker here as well. And so very involved, hands-on, day-to-day. This is where you'll find me.
Yeah, and you're clearly someone who believes in the importance of detail, research, exhaustive research. I think your background in tech probably has something to do with that, the way your brain works, your love of maths and that kind of thing. Yeah. Tell us about how you went about finding the perfect spot for your vines.
Yeah, so look for me, vineyards in particular are all science. There's certainly plenty of art, plenty of room for art in the wineries, but in the vineyards, for me, it's all science. So, you know, Fiona and I became very excited, you know, back in 2000 when a friend gave us blind, our first English sparkling, much better than we'd expected. We spent the next 2 or 3 years trying to understand why that was. And it's sort of embarrassing to say it now, but the answer after 2 or 3 years was quite clear. It was that it wasn't that the climate was changing. It was that the climate had changed. And when we looked at the way the climate in southern England overlaid with the climate you'd seen in Champagne, which is only 100, 150 miles south, over the sort of, you know, the period of, you know, 1900 to 1970, it was obviously very similar. And we were well aware that most of the world's chalk is in northern France and southern England. It pops up in some very famous spots, Burgundy and Champagne most notably, comes under the English Channel and reemerges in the South Downs and Chiltern Hills, as well as other little outcrops. But there is an awful lot of chalk around. Chalk is really, really interesting and useful stuff. Most obviously, for me, it has two critical features. One, vines really struggle in chalk. And secondly, it free drains, which if you're going to plant vines in England, is extremely important. So we began to seriously look at undertaking a project looking for the right land all across southern England. And to do that, I've started a number of businesses in my life. Whenever you do, you need to build a team around you that knows what good looks like. And I think we'll come on to talk about perhaps Michelle Salk a little later. But Professor Salk had been very involved at Rhoda. He'd started up the vineyards for Rhoda Estate in the Anderson Valley in California. He taught winemaking and had grown up in Epernay. He was a lovely person to work with and a real expert in his field. And so we teamed up with Michelle and then began our search, really looking all across southern England, but particularly in chalk valleys. I think chalk valleys have a number of features. I've talked a little bit about the chalk, but also the slopes, the airflow those bring, often wooded around the vineyards, which can be very helpful for a number of reasons. So lots of little things we were even initially looking for. We ended up looking over 3 years at over 300 sites, and we looked at 100 in detail with sampling soils. Michelle had access to CIVC in Champagne to do so, but also then doing climate modelling. And a lot of climate modelling, it's microclimate modelling, really. I mean, the macro data is easy to obtain, but the microclimate data is very important. And you're really looking at, I think, particularly how air flows actually around the land. So a lot of that's topographical. There's a lot of data available. So, yes, a very, very sort of scientific approach to selecting the land. There are a number of features I think you need in England if you're going to plant vineyards that are going to be commercially successful and really allow you to produce very high-quality wines. And there aren't as many good locations as people think. You hear a lot of myths out there around perhaps planting on south-facing slopes and the like, which are really just that, just myths. They may have some grain of truth to them, but only a grain. There's a lot more you need. You know, even the thinnest band of clay will often make land unsuitable for vineyards in certain locations. Lots and lots of little details that all matter. So, yes, a huge effort over 3 years before we finally got to 100 Hills. You know, an exhaustive search. I don't think we ever gave up. We knew there was land that was interesting. We were looking at a lot of land that wasn't for sale. So we knew we would be inevitably left looking for land sometimes that we couldn't acquire. But finally, after 3 years, we found the land here in the Stoner Valley in Oxfordshire, which was absolutely perfect for what we were looking for and has proved to be ever since.
And was that a eureka moment when you saw 100 Hills for the first time?
No, I wouldn't describe it as a eureka moment. I certainly knew when I saw it for the first time that it was interesting and potentially suitable. But it's not until you see the data. It's not until you see the granular data on the soils. It's not until you really model airflow properly. You really look at the orientations of the valley, the orientations of the woodland, that you really understand what that really is, does have everything you're looking for. So no eureka moment, but I think as I got deeper into the data, 100 Hills in particular, there was a moment where we thought, yes, this really is it. And as we began to negotiate for the land, I think we realized, you know, sometime in the latter part of 2012 that we'd finally found our home.
Yeah, you're probably a bit too data-driven and scientific for a eureka moment, I suspect.
My eureka moments here have come actually when we've been making wines and tasting wines, particularly base wines. There have been certain years and certain vintages and certain base wines I've tasted that I still remember, where you've said to yourself, gosh, yes, that really is everything we'd hoped we could bring to bear here. So the eureka moments have come, you know, often tasting base wines in April, and sometimes tasting finished wines as we begin to release wines. But the vineyards, as I say, for me are so data driven. We do so much out there. We have lots of different sensors out there. We do research with the Horizon Fund. We're monitoring vines, you know, all the time, extremely closely, 10 parcels. We're reacting in real time as the situation changes every year. And all of that is pretty data-driven. It's scientific. As I say, I think when you're tasting wines and creating wines, there's a lot more art involved. Tasting base wines is an art form. There's only so much you can measure that's useful. But out in the vineyard, we're really pretty data-driven, yeah.
Stephen Duckett, co-founder at 100 Hills in the Chilterns. Well, spring has sprung there, so thoughts are no doubt turning to rosé, though, of course, in reality, that is a year-round wine. Provence is, of course, its spiritual home, and Romaine Hot is rosé royalty. Domaine Hot was a pioneer in the region, but he decided to plough a different path, joining the Bamford family as they re-established Chateau Léhoube as a dynamic organic producer. Romain is head winemaker at Chateau Léhoube, and I put it to him that rosé must run through his veins.
I don't know if it throws to my veins, but yes, I'm the... Usually I just to explain as a joke, but it's not a joke, I'm the neighbor's son. That's when I grew up really next door to Chateau Léhoube. Of course, with the rosé production around me and in my family, and rosé is historic in Provence, and its production is really dedicated to this wine with a savoir-faire and sort of history of the rosé making.
Yes, I mean, you are the neighbour's son. That's true. It does sound like it's a joke, as you say, but it's actually true. The Ott name, I mentioned it's rosé royalty and you're being very modest, but tell us about the family, because you have this incredibly long-running connection with this style of wine, don't you?
Of course. When you grow up in a winemaker family with a style, with a sort of when you grow up in a winemaker family for who the only target is quality and balanced wine, of course you have it in your mind every day, and that's the way to act for you. Yeah, my family was probably the pioneer of one of the pioneer on the rosé making, and they wanted to produce a high quality wine and sell it many years ago, which it was very rare at this moment. Yeah, it's still a style and a reference in Provence, because they were the pioneer on the winemaking, rosé, high-quality rosé winemaking, and selling all around the world. So, of course, yes, I kept a part of this philosophy.
And it's worth saying the Ott name, Domaine Ott, goes back a very long way. That's actually now part of a different owner, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. But the story continues, and the production and the sales and the quality of the range of this company is still growing and still running.
Oh, yes, it certainly is. And you moved across to Chateau Lehoubs, which was purchased by the Bamford family, obviously a fairly famous British name because of JCB, J.C. Bamford, the diggers and the excavation kind of equipment. Yeah. They purchased Chateau Lehoubs in 1997, long before Provence Rosé became the height of fashion that it is today. They, the Bamfords, were really ahead of their time, weren't they?
I would say yes and no. You know, at the beginning, they were not especially looking for a wine estate. There's no secret on that. And they were looking for a place in the south of France, and probably got the opportunity to buy Chateau Lehoubs. They were ahead of their time, maybe not on the rosé market or rosé making, but probably on the specific and the rarity of the place and the attractivity of the Provence. Because now it's very, very attractive, not only for the wines, but for just the location. And yes, they were probably ahead of their time, as you said, on this point. But you know, they are farmers. They are not only equipment or machine builders and producers. They also are farmers, and they're respectful on the environment. And as there were vineyards on Chateau Lehoubs, on Lehoubs, they decided to develop the wine production on the high quality. And yes, it's now we could say they were ahead of their time, because they wanted to refurbish the whole estate and the vineyard with only one objective, was quality, and only quality, and quality first, which is just exceptional for the place. And maybe they were a little ahead because they knew that was the probably not the only way, but the best way for a wine estate development.
Tell us about the soil, the land, the terroir that you grow the grapes on.
Chateau Lehoubs is located really on the coastline, on a the schistous part of the Provence, that means really the coastline, which is a little different compared to the rest of Provence, which is more calcareous. We are on a mix of clay, sand, and schist, which is very well drained. There are, yeah, I would say poor soil, but very active. The mineralization and the activity in the soil is high. So it allows us to produce really balanced grapes and vines. Of course, we need to help it by seeding, by organic manure, by green manure using. And it's probably a little different on the balance of the grapes compared to the north of Provence. So that's the soil. But after that, you have the climate, which is very helpful because really close to the sea. And there's a lot of, the sea temperate a lot the climate. The winter is never too cold and the summer is hot, but never too hot because of the breeze and the humid nights and fresh nights. So it's a very good alternancy on the maturity, and all those two plus the action of the growers makes the terroir. Yes, it's a very specific terroir because of the schistus, because of the schistus soil, because of the sea, and because Les Aubineux is like a sort of an amphitheater between the hills behind it and the sea face to it. So it's very protected.
Does feel like an amphitheatre when you stand on the hills as well and look out towards the sea. It's a really awe-inspiring view. It's a very good word, amphitheatre, to describe it. You farm organically, of course. Yeah. Why is organic viticulture important?
Organic. Now we call it organic. Now there's some rules and some certification, but it's just I would say the right sense. You know, it's in French, we say le bon sens paysan, so farmer's right sense. So that's, for me, the logical way to cultivate. Of course, we don't use any pesticides, we don't use any weed killers. And the aim is to have the high respect of the plant, and because I think main part of the job for a winemaker is done in the vineyard. If you do all your best to get balanced vines, they will give you balanced fruits, and those fruits will give you balanced wines. So it's just, for me, especially in such area, it's just no sense to work differently. You know, it's a normal way. You can't spray. You can't spray pesticides. You can't spray some weed killers, because if you want to have real balanced product and the, you know, all you think you spray, all the thing you put in the soil, at the end you will get them back in the wines one day. So more you are respectful, more you are traditional, more you respectful of the plants, more you will have balanced wines and digestible wines, which is very important too.
Romain Ott on the importance of working with nature at Chateau Les Aubes. And if Romain surprised a few people by flying the family nest, then Emmanuel Pesquera surprised no one in his family by entering the world of hospitality, because he was choosing to serve people at a very young age. After then training as a chef, the wine list became his obsession, and he's now risen to group head of wine for Gordon Ramsay restaurants. He told me how his career took shape at a very young age.
My hospitality started from home. My mom used to call me, still calls me, the perfect host. This is where it's kind of all started at the beginning. You know, my mom was a great cook. Father collected wine. father Swiss, mother Portuguese. Still remember these lovely labels of Mouton Rothschild coming around the tables and so forth. Actually grown up in a family where education was a must. My father worked for Microsoft for many years as a game designer. I even myself possess a master's degree in game design, and you see I end up now in wine and food. Further that, I started doing what I loved. My journey was quite simple, but as well in the same time was super complex, because I always kind of wanted to always dream big and dream bigger than I wanted, and I always wanted to go as far as I could. I naturally ascended, through a wide variety of roles within the hospitality industry, was definitely with high performance and service delivery. Before I joined Gordon Ramsay restaurants, I started as a chef on a Crystal Cruise Line. Then I moved into restaurant manager, then bar manager, then head sommelier. It's supposed to be a 9-month contract to see the world. End up doing 10 years of my life on a cruise ship. The vision on the beginning was to become an F&B director. I always wanted to work in every little corner of hospitality to make sure and understand what my team will feel if I ever will be their manager or their leader. And this is where the journey started. I then moved to UK in 2012. I worked with Eric Zwiebel, Master Sommelier, dropped down from Head of Beverage all the way down to Assistant Cellar Master to understand the concept of UK, where he was my mentor. I actually joined him when he was doing the World Best Sommelier, which is quite impressive to walk in into a room where you have 100 wines to taste every breakfast, lunch and dinner, which was quite, he used to call it Breakfast for Champion, which I agree fully. From there, I moved in the same company, Red Carnation, to Central London, to the Milestone Hotel as F&B Operation Manager. And then after that, I moved to Oxford and Cambridge Private Member Club, then Intercontinental to open my first hotel, then speeding forward to Edwardian Hotel Group, as well as an F&B Manager and Director. And then from there, COVID unfortunately hit. And then after that, I joined 67 Pall Mall just for a 6-month refreshment and in depth after 1 year back into the wine world. However, in every position I have taken as an F&B manager, the wine was always under my wings in terms of purchasing, training, wine list, curated food and beverage. And I had as well a huge finance background, so I was quite strong in all triangle, and I call it triangle of fire. You have the wine, you have the food, and you have the finance on the other side.
Very important, especially the finance, but that's probably the most boring part.
Yes, it is.
Albeit very important. I'm very interested in the fact that you started as a chef. Do you think that gives you a different perspective on wine and pairing?
Ah, huge. I believe being able to break down a dish when it stands or you read it in a menu, it's a huge advantage that you have as a sommelier when it comes to food and wine pairing. Because as we all know, on a dish is always a protein, there's always the vegetable element, and there's always what we call the starch, could be a potato, could be a pasta, could be anything of that sort. There's always a triangle on the plate. And beside that is the jus and the sauce that you want to use, which is actually impact massively on the saltiness, sweetness, and acidity of any wine you would like to recommend. Having the diversity as well to be able to visit more than 3,000 cities around the world give me advantage in my experience to be able as well to taste and visit the places from all around the world. You know, talking about culinary in India, talking Japanese cuisine, talking about the Italian cuisine. You know, we had two restaurants, 3-star Michelin on board the ship, which is Piero Salvaggio and Nobu Matsuhisa, you know, top element accolades in the world of fine food. And as well, having the finance, as you said, background, it helps you breaking down the food into costings and be able to curate something, an incredible journey for the guest. But this is one of the biggest question. With one of them is what makes a great sommelier, I believe. It's important that, you know, people understand how passion coming through the heart to the people make things such a huge difference. It's like how the people feel after the first sip of wine, that liquid, take you into a science, take you into history, take you into tradition, even to nature. This is drinking wine, you know, for me, it's all about experience and that little touch of memories that you have in that moment.
I was going to ask you what makes a perfect sommelier, but you've kind of answered that question with the word passion. Is that what you're looking for first and foremost when you recruit members of your team?
I believe beside passion is the attitude. I believe if you have the right attitude, you can learn anything in life. We none of us grown up knowing what we know and finding what we love. But I believe the perfect sommelier is the epitome of expertise, passion, the service excellence in the world of wine. You know, they are not just connoisseurs, but they are guides and curators of an unforgettable experience. You know, at the heart of the craft, you know, lies as well that unparalleled depth of knowledge. A perfect sommelier does not only knows about wine, they live and breathe them. You know, we breathe wine, we live with it 24/7. You know, our expertise is vast and comprehensive, but as well is how we are able as well to have the pleasure of sharing our knowledge with people. Because this is what defects many multiple sommeliers and the difference between a great sommelier and a world-class sommelier, you know, as well as about the exceptional communication skills, able to convey complex concepts with clarity and passion, you know, to guide guests through the intricate world of wine with ease, make it accessible, enjoyable for all. You know, passion is the driving force behind every great sommelier. You know, the love for wine is palpable, infectious. You know, I call it infectious, like a virus. You know, fueling their unsettable curiosity and driving them to explore new wines. You know, as well, perfect sommelier, you know, always keenly attuned to the needs and the preference of their guest. It's not about what they like. You know, they need to have an incredible listen capability, understanding each individual guest taste, budget, occasion. Tailor recommendation, the delight and surprise is an equal measure.
Emmanuel Pisquera on the secret of a good sommelier. And when it comes to secrets, Hannah Crosby has chosen to share a few in her very honest debut work, Corker, billed as a deeply unserious wine book. In it, she urges us to forget some of the pretensions that surround wine, and she turns pairing on its head with some novel ideas for matching wine with occasions. We caught up to mark the launch of the book.
The reason I wanted the fact that it was a deeply unserious wine book at the core of the book itself is because I don't take many things extremely seriously. I mean, I absolutely adore the world of wine, through which I've had incredible experiences, met some of my favorite people, and tasted countless amazing wines. And as a bit of like a history and anthropology buff, it's incredibly gratifying. But would I don't know, sacrifice my firstborn child for it? Definitely not. I think that a lot of people kind of approach wine with a real seriousness, which is great. I do take a lot of wine like very seriously. I take my pleasure and my enjoyment of it very seriously. But I think it's the seriousness that puts people off getting into it in the first place. I think that, you know, as with getting into anything or trying something new or trying a new hobby, you're just anxious about the mistakes you make. And, you know, I think in wine more so than perhaps many other areas of interest, people are a little bit less forgiving because quite a high level of knowledge, I feel like, is required for people to feel confident about talking about it in the first place. So I think that through, as a wine professional, being like, guys, I don't take myself too seriously, so why should you be afraid to make mistakes? Everyone makes mistakes when they're learning about something as deeply complex as wine. Putting kind of the word unserious on the front cover is just sort of a representation of that, really. I don't take myself too seriously, so neither should you.
Yes, and the wine world doesn't always help itself. There's the, you know, old cliche of someone saying that they don't like Chardonnay, but it turns out they do like Chablis. And then everyone has a good laugh about the fact that Chablis is, of course, Chardonnay. But actually, I always cringe because, in a sense, you shouldn't have to know which grape goes in which wine. If you like Chablis, just knowing you like Chablis is enough, isn't it?
100%. And I think I talk about in the book, you know, I also talk about in my wine club, so long as you're armed with the kind of wine that you like, unless you're looking to go into a career in wine, but most people who come to my wine clubs aren't. They're just looking for the vocabulary and they're looking for the information. I say if you go into a wine shop or a restaurant armed with the knowledge of the wine that you yourself like, then you're completely unstoppable. And really, it's great. It's great to explore and discover, but do you really need to know anything else? I think it's crazy that such a high level of knowledge is needed or required for you to be taken seriously as, you know, like a wine buff or someone with an interest in wine. When, yeah, you're right. That's all you really need to know.
Yeah. And actually, Chablis, that's quite a good observation on their part, because it is a bit different to what you'd get in the Côte d'Or or whatever. So it's even a really good observation. It's just that people react to it in a certain way. And that brings us neatly to the glossary. I wouldn't normally kind of dwell on a glossary in talking to someone about their book, but I think it's really relevant here to what you just said. And you've got a really neat way of explaining some quite complex things in the glossary. I was particularly struck by carbonic maceration, because I spent anxious weeks or even months trying to understand, while I was doing my diploma, the complex process of intracellular fermentation. And actually, you've managed to boil down carbonic maceration to about 25 words.
Ah, yes. Well, I mean, I think I say in the book, like, who's got time to be reading a glossary? And if you want it to be, you know, I don't think that it's a book that you read cover to cover. I want it to be a book that you kind of dip in and out as and when you need it. And if you do see a word that you don't necessarily understand, then you don't necessarily want to be spending. I mean, I, for one, you know, love taking the time to read longer pieces of text on, yeah, exactly the kinds of processes you're talking about. But the average person, do they? I mean, there's also, like, as you say, like a wealth of knowledge and information out there if you want to get really nerdy with it. But if you're dipping in and out of a book to, you know, get the information you need and maybe have a laugh, then yeah, I think it's important to kind of maybe not dwell too long and really only kind of give you the key need to knows, right?
Yeah. And I don't want to give the wrong impression of the book here, because I'm going to talk about malolactic fermentation now. This is not what the book is about. This is the glossary and that's it. But I'm just curious as to where you honed your skills in translating complex things into very, very simple, relatable language, because you're very good at it.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I think that most definitely comes from my work as a copywriter. So I've always been a copywriter, and a lot of that is, yeah, as you say, honing things down and making, like, selling things in, I don't know, yeah, 25 words or less. And I think also what I've learned as a copywriter, and one of the most important skills that I've learned as a copywriter going into this and becoming an author, is really refining your audience and what they need to know and what they want to get out of. I think that with wine writing, it can go one of two ways, right? You're either there, like, solely to serve and inform, or you're there to be like, oh, look what a great writer I am. And I think I'm kind of like somewhere in the middle. Obviously, I want everyone to have a laugh and not take things too seriously when they're reading the book. But at the same time, we are ultimately there to serve and relay information and kind of draw people in and welcome them into the world of wine in that way. So yes, I would say my background in copywriting for sure is what's really, really helped me refine some of these concepts and make them a little bit digestible for the reader.
We've established it's a great glossary. Let's get on to the book itself, because it's not an encyclopedia at all. It is broadly about pairing wines with situations. How did that idea come about?
So I get a lot of DMs, direct messages on social media and emails, to be fair, from people asking me for their wine recommendations. Generally speaking, it's kind of like this new generation of wine drinkers. So, you know, early 20s to late 30s, early 40s. And I've kind of noticed a pattern that's popped up over the past, you know, 5 years post, or 4 years post lockdown, when a lot more people in that age bracket got into wine. I've found that when they get in touch, they don't say, oh, I'm having a fillet of salmon tonight, what should I have? I found that when this generation wants something that's perfectly matched to the food they're eating, they're very happy to go out and pay for like a very qualified professional to do that for them. At home, however, it tends to be, so yeah, it's not, I'm having a fillet of salmon, what should I have? It's, I'm going to a barbecue and I don't know anyone. Like, what wine do I bring to, you know, make some new friends? Or I'm meeting my girlfriend's parents the first time. What wine do I bring to like really impress them? So I find that people are drinking more situationally, and they care more about things like, you know, who they're drinking the wine with and how much they should be spending. And the idea that when you bring a bottle of wine to a function, it ultimately does say something about you.
Hannah Crosby talking to me in the penultimate episode of Series 13 about her new work, Corker. And that concludes our highlights for this series. Thanks to all of those I have spoken to, and thank you to you for listening. Do join us next week as we launch Series 14 of The Drinking Hour.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode, in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.